Good afternoon and welcome to Long-Term Care Services Provider Call, Wednesday, May the 6th. Hope everybody is doing good. The weather's looking great. Now all we need is COVID to clear up. So I want to remind you all the calls are muted. The session is being recorded. Hold all your questions for the Q&A session at the end. As always, if you have a question, you can call us at 405-271-6868. Or email ltc@health.ok.gov, or you can go to our website at ltc.health.ok.gov and look for the LTC COVID-19 resource page, which we are currently working on and updating. So we're going to move right on into our guidance and want to welcome our Assistant Deputy Commissioner, James Jocelyn.
First and in.
We have a long list here today, James.
We do. And about that, I would say that, as reflecting the multiple things that come up and are submitted to us as things to address, the actual agenda itself will go out. The detailed agenda is going to go out during this call. And when you get that, you will also get a link to last week's agenda, and all of the Q&A that we did last week where we've updated some of those responses and provided links to documents. So that will be as a part of your handout, that will be in the email distribution that will go out during the call today. That's it.
First up is a question about the expiration of the CNA, and Matt, has there been any extension or changes to that?
Yeah, so the question was raised about, with some of the updates in the governor's executive order, what was the timeline now for any occupational licenses expiring or not. There was no change in the executive order. That executive order still provides that all occupational licenses, and that includes certifications of medication aids, are extended for the duration of the emergency and 14 days past. That's it.
Involuntary discharge. So I put this one on here. Okay, so we've always been saying it's recommended if you transfer somebody to a hospital that our expectations are that you would take them back. Haven't had much of a problem with that. Early on we did, and questions about that. Now there's been additional question about testing before they leave the hospital, quarantining, and I'm going to add a little twist to this. Now what do you do when the ALJ provides an order for you to accept them back? And this is thrown out to the panel. So we got an involuntary discharge determined by an ALJ, or a facility is told to take the resident back and still refusing. Do we go to district court? Do we give them a call and have them understand the implications of the decision that they're making?
Yeah, I think that's where you start, is calling the facility to talk them through this and what's behind it, and then you know, you see where you are at that point and then look at pursuing further sanction or district court.
So as we move along, I want to, you know, bring up changes to what's going on. And this is the first time we've had one of these in a while. So basically, if the ALJ is gone out and said that you're ordered to take the resident back and perform a proper discharge, then we recommend you do it. Otherwise, we will pursue enforcement actions. Okay. COVID positive staffing. So that has come up here in the last week with two or three different facilities. And James had sent out a guidance on this. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to just briefly go over what we're looking for. If you are thinking that you want to pursue COVID-positive staffing, there's going to be four questions that we send you. So the first question is, we're going to want to know, what have you done to transfer patients with COVID-19 to designated health care facilities or alternate care sites? Other words, do you have a sister facility where you can relocate residents? Is there a hospital that will take some of that burden? That's question one. Question two will be, what have you done to meet adequate staffing using either staffing agencies or contacting our Medical Reserve Corps? I'm going to want to know that you have reached out to the Medical Reserve Corps, want to make sure that you contacted staffing agencies, and basically looking for evidence that they have not been able to meet your request. Then it'll move on to the third question, says, how many COVID positive staff are you requesting to use? So how many people do you want to use? How long are they into their monitoring period? Have they been asymptomatic for 5 days, 6 days, or on their 13th day? What are your infection control measures for where COVID positive staff will work? So, I mean, our recommendation right now is kind of three-pronged. One, negative residents together. Two, infection control together. I'm sorry. Two would be COVID positive residents, and the third one is the quarantine as to where they go in between. And so we want to know how your COVID positive staff are going to work, if they're only going to work with COVID positive residents. And then the other thing we want to know is, you're going to get a lot of questions, and we want to know what message you'll provide to residents, resident representatives and facility staff about actions that will be taken to protect them from exposure to COVID-19 if the staff with suspected or confirmed COVID-19 are allowed to work. And like I said, I know we've gone over this, but with the mandatory testing that we're doing now, I expect to see an increase in the number of positive staff and trying to answer this question in a proper order so that we could address this issue when it comes up. Anything to add on any of that?
No.
So we had somebody send in who wanted us to talk about staff that are working when they're positive.
Well, refer back to the previous topic. Until you have a clearance from us that the criteria have been met and appropriate protections are in place, that's not approved.
Correct. So if you're interested in this, you can email me, mikec@health.ok.gov, and I will send you the questions that we are looking for you to answer. The authority for approving that is with long-term care. I'll review it and discuss that with James, Paula, and we'll make a decision on whether you can do that or not. But don't do it unless you have been approved to do it. So, James, on the facility-wide testing, can you tell us, I know that started, well, we were talking last week, it's just going to start the next day, which is Thursday or Friday. So where are we and what's going on with that?
So, yes, so that has started with, as you would might expect, some mixed results. So we issued Friday late through Gov Delivery to all of you who are subscribers the Commissioner's Statement on Task Force Scope and Authority, and included in that the guidance to the task forces on conducting the testing and coordinating with facilities. And we reiterated to these task forces an expectation that the task force coordinate with the facility to do the testing. And that priority, what has been established as the priority at this time, is nursing facilities and skilled nursing facilities. And by that, I do not mean ICFI IDs, that the task forces, their first priority is Tier 1, 2, and 3 facilities with exposure. And to reiterate, Tier 1 is there was a COVID death or there are three or more residents positive in the – three or more staff positive in the facility. Tier 2 is you have a resident – two residents or a resident and a staff member positive. Tier 3 is one resident or less than three staff members who are positive. So those facilities are the first priority, whether it's a nursing home or an assisted living center, ICFIID, residential care. Those are the first priority, and then moving beyond that, in each task force region or district that they work in will be the remaining nursing facilities. The testing, the primary testing media being offered is the saliva test, and the as a part of the pre-site visit, the task force instructions include the facility, the task force finding out how many residents you have who, that would not be able to do a saliva sample, in which case they'll be prepared to do swabs. I am aware that there have been some differences in how the task forces initially approached facilities, and we asked them and did approve them coordinating various approaches to this that include providing the sample collection media to a staff member to carry out the sample collection, so long as that staff member has been observed and trained to do the collection and found to meet the standards that they want followed in sample collection. Other approaches have been setting up outside for the staff to provide their samples. So different approaches to try to minimize contact and exposure within the facilities. Facilities have expressed concerns about the staff coming in. So as far as those samples that have been collected, we pushed hard. We got a lot of facilities done very quickly, and we overwhelmed the company that's processing the media. Initially, there was a delay in getting the samples to them, and then beyond that, there was a delay just with the volume. So they are working to address that. I understand that they're roughly at about a 48-hour delay once they get the samples to getting those results back. But those results, excuse me, will go back to the task force and to the facility so that the facility is aware of any staff that are going to have to be pulled off the shifts. Those are being shared with the facilities. The delay that has existed since we roughly began last Wednesday, we believe is getting caught up. Samples are being submitted every day except Sunday, which is the day that I guess samples are not being collected, but they're submitting every day. Once we complete all the nursing homes, then the evaluation will get underway about expanding out to the other long-term care facilities. Decisions have not been made on that yet.
What about campuses where you may have nursing home, assisted living, independent, they may share resources. How are we looking at those?
So we have, so the task forces have to carry out things based on their resources. And then, as I mentioned, in some instances, the facilities are, the facility staff are assisting the sample collection across, and could assist across the campus. But where you've got large campuses, the task forces have to evaluate that, and the first priority being the nursing facilities. But what we've suggested and what we will do is work with the task force to go ahead and test that entire campus with the feeling that, you know, let's identify any asymptomatic, pre-symptomatic staff and or residents anywhere on that campus with the goal of doing the cohorting and separating and removing staff that might infect other staff and or residents. So it's a call that's going to be made by the local task force based on their resources and their assessment of the risk of transmission based on the exposures that are present.
So our next topic, as our exposure has increased and staff have become asymptomatic or positive in some cases, facilities are having concerns about staff that work at multiple facilities. Do we have recommended precautions that we could discuss for staff that work at these multiple facilities?
Well, what I've read is, you know, obviously all the staff are supposed to be wearing a face mask. If you have a staff member who's working at multiple facilities, then your precautions are going to be heightened for that staff person. You might restrict what they're doing, but there's not a specific guidance for this that I'm aware of. I've not seen it. I'm looking around the room. Anyone? Anyone? Yeah, no, there's not. You know, as we've discussed before, the list of facilities with exposures is public record. It's published on our website every day. So you can see which facilities have exposure. Your staff, you know, should be counseled on their added risk and responsibility if they're working in multiple facilities, and that they have a heightened responsibility for their own personal infection control habits away from work and while on the job, and that if they can't uphold those, you know, then you look at, do I work them right now? Do I take that risk or not? Anything from anyone?
Okay, our next question comes from Paula Terrell. Out-of-state hospitals like Arkansas are not wanting to test residents prior to discharge.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about our guidance for testing prior to discharge from the hospital. And the first thing I want to say is that it's not mandatory, that you can request that test if you want to from the hospital. But I really think that mostly applies to Oklahoma hospitals. I'm not sure that any of the out-of-state hospitals have that obligation, James, unless you want to interject.
Well, no, out-of-state hospitals don't have an obligation. I want to step back a piece, though. So there is an expectation. So it's not the facility's obligation to request that discharge test in Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, the hospitals have been told they will provide a discharge test.
Okay.
That's the standard for them to meet.
And okay.
So
if they want to accept them back without a test, though,
they can.
They can.
Yes.
Quarantine.
And then we get into some questions about the guidance after that. But just know that if you do accept them back and they're negative, even though you have that negative test, you're still required to put them in quarantine for 14 days to make sure they don't have symptoms.
Yes, and we covered that in more detail we covered that last week, and in the Q&A document that's going out today from last week, you'll see more detail there where we talk through that, you know, the fact that you get that negative test of discharge does not remove your standards for treating that admission like you would any admission and putting them in a 14-day quarantine.
Absolutely. And then that second negative test could be optional. And if you did it, probably the more appropriate time would be at the end of the 14-day quarantine.
But it is not required to do a second test.
Right.
The guidance, there's not a particular CDC guidance. And I know Janine has identified even more questions and issues that have come up. Is that later on the agenda, or is that do we board that in right now?
We can address anything when we want to.
Janine, are we at a point to address that, or do we need to have more internal discussions to make sure?
I think we need some more internal discussions. However, some of the communications that I have had with facilities is really the clarification of second test, stopping quarantine early before the 14 days is up, and those sorts of things, which, again, we did reiterate that on a call last week. So your testing during that time frame does not eliminate the need for the 14 days, and I think that bears repeating over and over again. The testing, absolutely, CDC recommends if you choose to test once they are at that day 14 quarantine, that would probably be the most telltale sign of are we positive and asymptomatic or not. Because during that 14 days, if you test at day 5, that doesn't mean at day 14 you won't be positive after you were negative. So in looking at that, if they are choosing to do that testing strategy to remove them from the quarantine and transmission-based precautions, then that day 14 would be the best time frame to do it in. And then as far as just some of the other things, I know I have been questioned, and I think you all have been as well, just regarding the time frame of the testing and return of the results prior to discharge from the hospital, and that's something I think we probably need to discuss and iron out, because not only are we getting calls from long-term care, we're getting them from hospital facilities across the state as well as other states to have that explained a little bit clearer. So I think we have an opportunity to kind of maybe help iron that out.
Yeah, and to go back, the out-of-state hospital, you know, so for the facility that, you know, you're talking to the hospital in Arkansas, for instance, probably be the one that immediately comes to mind, but that says we're not doing that test. And it's like, well, then your facility makes a call about, all right, you know, and I would say look at the medical record of that patient. What were they treated for? Are they displaying any current signs of upper respiratory infection? Okay, nothing at all. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and take them and put them in quarantine, which you would do with any new admission anyway. And you would put them under observation in that capacity.
Yeah, and in all honesty, most of the other states every state has this, where folks kind of maybe go across the border when they're bordering towns. And a majority of our bordering, as well as others, that the facilities are struggling the same as ours are to have the availability and the ability to kind of push those through like we can do locally. And none of the ones I've spoken to, whether they're here or somewhere else, have refused the test. I think it's the time frame that has been the confusion, that they can't provide it in that 48 hours. And again, you're absolutely right. Looking at why the resident was admitted in the first place, they might have been a 23-hour obs because they fell. They weren't there. So I think some of that is where the questions are coming from, more or less, how do we handle those situations?
Yeah.
So one of the things is we're doing our COVID-focused surveys that we would cite facilities for that we have not yet would be the N95 fitting, because we do get, fortunately, we see a lot of people wearing N95 masks. Unfortunately, we see them not being fit tested. So what is the recommendation on that? And I didn't know if you want to talk about possible considerations yet or not.
Well, so Janine can speak to, as we've stressed here, there's a time and a place to wear the N95, and the use of N95s that have not been fit tested and are not being worn appropriately create their own problems. There's a standard for N95s that includes a medical evaluation. This is an OSHA standard that if you're going to place your employees in responsibilities that put them at risk for breathing an infectious agent, then they have to be appropriately medically screened to see if they have pre-existing medical conditions that would put them at even greater risk with this exposure. So there's that medical screening that's to occur, and that medical screening is there's a series of questions that are laid out by OSHA that have to be completed, and that the response to those questions then triggers a medical evaluation if they answer yes to certain questions. That medical screening is done by a licensed healthcare professional, an appropriately licensed healthcare professional, who evaluates that employee's medical situation against the type of respirator that they would wear and the circumstances in which they'll wear it. So all of those pieces come into play in getting that medical evaluation. So as we have been looking at this, we've talked about, we contracted with a company to provide some support for fit testing, while also asking you to move forward with getting your own staff fit tested. We want to reiterate that those staff that would absolutely need to wear the N95 is if you're dealing with aerosolizing procedures with residents who are COVID positive or suspected COVID. And aside from that, and so required, there's required, and then recommended would be the staff with direct patient, providing direct care services. So the RNs, the LPNs, CMAs, and CNAs that are in close contact with a COVID positive or suspected COVID positive resident. So to the extent that you cohort your residents, you're now down to a smaller number of staff that need to be fit tested for the N95, and you've got to have sufficient staff to cover your day, evening, night shift, cover your weekends, and some backup, right? So trying to understand that and who can do your medical evaluation for you, those are all the pieces that we're aware of that are having to fit together to get this done. And then it gets complicated further by which N95, when you're fit tested for an N95 respirator, if you later get a different type of respirator, that fit test may not apply, and you have to have another fit test done. So as we're trying to recognize all these challenges that our facilities have, we're reevaluating our vendor contract to look at expanding that to be more proactive in offering the fit testing. We're having discussions about that today. We've identified a lot of these questions, and what we're looking at doing is to go ahead and direct call all of our facilities, again, COVID-exposed homes first, and then follow-on facilities to identify how many staff meet that criteria that we just talked about, for you to have a team available so that such time you have a COVID exposure in your home, you've got a team of nurses, of RNs, LPNs, and aides who are ready to, they've already been fit tested, and they will be your strike team to be able to provide support to that COVID cohort. To do that, we've got to have, you would have to identify who's going to do that medical evaluation for you. That's not part of what we're providing. That's done by the facility.
We have had questions, you know, their RNs, DONs want to know how they would qualify to be able to fit test.
And we're researching that question because it says licensed healthcare professional. Your supervisor can't do the medical evaluation of you. I did read that today in the respiratory handbook, but it could be a licensed nurse. But they've got to have the training and skills to do that evaluation, and I'm not sure that they're going to be prepared to do that just off the cuff. So looking at that, I'm not sure your medical director would be, you know, skilled or trained to make that evaluation on the type of mask either. So the way that process works is we identify the administrator, the contact, and the number of staff, and that you've got identified who would do the medical screening. And then our contract liaison sends an email to your administrator. They get access to the web portal where then they put their staff in who are going to be tested. Those staff get sent an email with a medical questionnaire that they complete, and it goes back to the vendor. The vendor then sends it back to the facility administrator to say, all right, they need a medical clearance. The administrator does not get the questionnaire. That's protected personal health information. So I'm getting a little into the weeds, but I want to give you a feel for kind of what the logistics are that we're trying to hopefully kind of upfront coordinate so that we can move this forward and help you get your staff protected. So I say that in a long answer to, a very long answer, to the N95 question of the challenges that you're facing with it. I do want to let Janine say a word about the concerns with the use of the N95 and how that presents some additional risk of infection control by its improper use. You're squinching your eyes.
I was going to kind of talk about that further down on the agenda, but I can kind of, because I follow up anyway, so I'll go ahead and talk about the extended and limited. Okay. So in regards to the N95, James is absolutely right. You know, most of the facilities that are using them, tested or not, the manner in which folks are utilizing them are a bit concerning. A majority that I've talked to and been on site visits are using an extended wear approach. And aside from the people who need to be wearing them that are providing direct patient care, there are several others that are wearing them just throughout the facility all day long. So in that instance, a lot are now, you know, they're still saying, okay, we're going to give you a paper bag and we're going to give you a place to store them so that when you come back, you can use it again. So a big thing is understanding the difference between if you extend the wear and wear it an entire shift, you cannot put it in a bag and come back the next day to wear it. When they're worn in extended wear, you are typically, depending on the manufacturer, able to get anywhere from 8 to 12 hours continuous wear out of them. If you are choosing to assign an N95 to a staff member and you want to store them in a bag in between shifts, then you need to follow the limited reuse instructions, which means you put them on, you do your round of care, and then you doff them and put them in a paper bag or equivalent breathable container so that, number one, they're not wearing it throughout the shift. And what's happening is when they wear them nonstop, they are touching the outside, they are poking their faces and their noses through the mask because it's uncomfortable or they have an itch. They grab the front of it and squish it to readjust it. All of these things can cause cross-contamination onto your hands, to which then you touch things. They damage the mask and make them less protective because once you begin crushing them, the filtering material that's in there may not be as effective. And then, you know, a lot of folks are going and taking their breaks. Many times they're going outside to smoke, and they take the N95 and pull it down under their chin, and then they smoke, and then they put it back up, and they go and take care of residents with that same mask that has been outside, now exposed to smoke, exposed to multiple times of touching it with their hands, rubbing eyes, rubbing faces, messing with hair, talking on cell phones, all of which now become contaminated. So, you know, in understanding that they need to take those masks off and store them when they take a break, if they're going to the bathroom, take it off, put it in a bag. There's just all kinds of risks to these employees that are practicing this way that can then cause an issue for them later to be tested positive, develop symptoms, whatever that looks like. So that goes back to the whole thing of assigning the appropriate individuals who need to wear an N95 and ensuring they understand these are really only necessary when they are having close personal contact, delivering care to a confirmed or suspected case of COVID-19. This not only optimizes your PPE supply, it's just the right thing to do to ensure we aren't wearing them inappropriately. Some of these folks pull them off and twirl them in the air, set them down on tables, go into break rooms. So there's a lot of these observations that need to kind of be made and decisions to which are going to be beneficial for you, your staff, and your residents. So take a moment and pull up those CDC guidelines where it talks about N95 specifically extending the wear versus limited reuse. If you have questions, please feel free to reach out, and I can walk you through your specific scenario because each of you have different challenges in your spaces and things like that that may provide a little more insight on my side to be able to give you the best possible recommendations that are going to be safe and effective.
Okay, thanks. So I had a couple other topics here for Janine to go over. One was CDC changes that were made after April 30th.
So I'm sure most everybody has heard, but it bears repeating because it's yet another one of those changes that can impact two things. They have changed the names of the strategies by which to determine if an employee can return to work and when discontinuation of transmission-based precautions can be utilized for your residents. And essentially, they changed the name of the non-test-based strategy to symptom-based strategy because that criteria is based upon the 3 days fever-free as well as 7 days outside of symptoms and symptoms are resolving. So any of you that I had talked to previously, I kind of told you this in the beginning, just count 10 days from the start of symptoms to look at those discontinuation of precautions or return to work. The other one that is test-based is still the same as far as requiring the being fever-free and symptoms are resolving, plus the 2 tests that are done at least 24 hours apart, and both have to be negative on a consistent basis. in order to count. So just kind of being mindful of when you use the test based strategy, it has not changed. The symptom based strategy has changed to match the asymptomatic criteria. So across the board, it is 10 days from either positive test for asymptomatic or 10 days from symptom onset if you're choosing not to test for clearance. The summary of recent changes are at the top of each of those CDC pages, so you can see it right there where it kind of lays that out. Making sure to, in conversations with CDC yesterday, CDC recommends that if you begin a testing-based strategy to remove folks from precautions and cohorts, as well as using that for your return-to-work criteria, stick with that methodology. Do not bounce back and forth and say, we're not going to test this one for clearance, but we're going to test this one for clearance. You need it for consistency. And once you start on one trail, they recommend that you stick with it because then you have the consistency. You will have an easier time going back should you start developing new positives and you're utilizing the test-based strategy for removal. We're going to see, we will be able to see by which of those if this is, you know, it's not a bunny trail back and forth, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
So I'm going to get this question, so I'm going to ask it now. This is for staff and residents?
Correct. They made those statements based off of either one. Once you begin a return to work, particularly for healthcare providers, and once you do, if like we're doing the basically the point prevalence, we're going out and doing swabbing everyone and getting a baseline. If they begin to let folks come back to work,
and the 10 days for quarantine.
No, the 10 days are for clearance after onset of symptoms.
Okay.
That is that piece. If you're using that symptom based criteria.
So if you have a resident coming from a hospital, the recommendation is still the quarantine for 14 days.
Yes.
Okay.
If they were out for another reason, not COVID-related, if they went in and were COVID-related and tested positive, you're going to utilize that retesting, the two negative tests, to remove them from transmission-based precautions. Doesn't change what you do when you bring them back for the quarantine.
Okay. Another one was cohorting once cleared from COVID-19 transmission-based precautions.
Okay. So this question has come up a couple of times from facilities while we've been on site or on the phone. And for those facilities that have specific positive COVID residents on a cohort and a quarantine unit and a negative, once they've done their whichever strategy they've chosen, if they're doing testing based, once they get the two negative tests, they can move them out into the general population, but they need to ensure that the resident has been showered or bathed, depending on what their ADLs look like, clean clothes, do not take anything personal from the positive cohort to the general population room. Make sure everything is clean, things that need to be laundered, anything that can be wiped down for disinfection, anything that can't, bag it up and kind of hold it and don't take that in and expose then a brand new clean room on the negative side.
Should that be a breathable bag?
Not necessarily. I mean, you have soft things that could potentially not be able to be washed and dried. You could have
personal
effects. Yeah. I mean, a majority of things when folks have moved individuals into the cohort, that's been the recommendation. Do not take anything that doesn't need to go back and forth.
Right.
the longer these items sit, hopefully they are becoming, you know. But once you move them back, making sure that if it's somebody that needs to have a roommate, that you do not put them in a room with someone who has never tested positive for COVID. So if you've got two folks that have been positive and cleared, if that is a roommate situation in your facility, those two could be roomed together.
That's preferred.
But do not, you know, it's kind of like once you've separated a positive and you have the exposed, don't give them a roommate for 14 days in case they develop symptoms. It's kind of the same thought, because we don't know if we can become reinfected in that population or any population. So by reducing that risk factor of exposure, if they have to be in a roommate situation, put them with somebody who's already been positive but cleared from the cohort. And you're not going to find that in the guidelines. You're going to find that in an infection preventionist brain like mine to kind of help alleviate some of those concerns of additional reinfection or cross-contamination from a previous positive to someone who's never been positive. Many of you have facilities that are semi-private rooms and don't have a choice but to give them a roommate. So trying to take that approach to ensure the best, hopefully more safe reality when you begin to clear from those precautions.
So the next thing that we get is, I'm not a nursing home, and how does all this apply to me? So I thought we would just take a minute and say, what are the expectations for assisted living? Do I really need to do 14 days for quarantine, or can we just do 7? Or how do we look at PPE, or what's this testing thing that's going on? First thing I want to say is, the COVID-focused survey, although it was developed by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, we have gone into approximately 7 or 8 assisted livings and done a COVID-focused survey because we thought it was a best practice. So for those assisted living that are out there feeling maybe over-regulated, what would we have to say to them on the quarantining, the PE, and the testing?
We are trying to protect your population. We've got, if you look at the data, I'm not sure how many assisted living centers we have now with significant exposures, but I believe it's more than 5, with a few more that are emerging. So it's, and so we initially thought, and I still think it's true, I think the vectors for transmission in the assisted living center may not be as prevalent, but they are still there, and it still happened extensively in a few of them. Janine? Did I go too far with that?
Well, no, I was just going to say, you know, we keep hearing, you know, for years, we've heard there's an app for that. There's a CDC page for that.
Yes, there is.
There are very specific pieces for the different facility types, whether it's assisted living, whether it's an independent or retirement community setting. They all have very similar recommendations. But as they talk about the fact of these are vulnerable populations, this is why it's important to utilize a quarantine as best as possible. You have folks that are used to coming and going, then you alter the way that you do things, much like the discussion of they don't have to stay in their little apartment units or rooms if they're in an assisted living to where they're used to having a community. But you have to fall into those guidelines and be very deliberate. If they're coming out of their spaces, they must wear a mask. You know, you're dining. No, you don't want to do communal dining, but can you make it so they can come out and just pick up their food and walk back away? Can you practice social distancing that enables some of those activities in their mental health and well-being? So although you may not all be in one particular hallway where everybody's kind of in and out, even your providers have to be mindful of, I still need to put on the proper PPE so that when I go to the next room, I'm not taking anything with me because I have been in their living space. So I think that's the key to get folks to understand, as difficult and as challenging as the physical setup may be, it doesn't change the basic infection prevention practices. The same as if home health was coming into one of your homes to deliver wound care to someone in your family. You would want them to wear PPE so that, number one, they're not taking anything you have out of your home to someone else's, and you sure don't want them bringing something in from somewhere else. So, you know, personalize this a bit if it makes it easier for your staff to understand. This is for their protection, but it's also for the protection of your population. And James is absolutely right. We have seen the same thing happen with acquisition of COVID-19 after one person has returned and has it. So it's really important to maintain those practices so that you can keep your facility type safe.
I want the record to show that that's twice on this call that Janine has said I was right.
Uh-oh. That means you can't have another one. I'm just kidding.
So we did, and part of it, I think some of this is getting prompted because we did a commissioner memo that said the CMS guidance for nursing and skilled nursing facilities, and that's not ICFI IDs, that's nursing and skilled nursing facilities, that CMS guidance was mandatory. And so that caused some questions in folks. We previously issued the guidance for all of our providers that face masks are to be worn. That was and then and remains true is to wear a face mask. And what we're trying to do with that is that we put the face mask on your staff when they come in and reduce the risk of them coughing and spreading their little bug on some handrail that's then touched by someone else and then carried on the next one. That's why we want face masks on everyone. And not okay. So I'll get off that. But that standard for cohorting, for face mask use, to be prepared to respond when this comes knocking on your door, that applies equally to everybody. There are some heightened requirements for nursing and skilled nursing facilities right now. We issued a guidance about not doing communal dining and not doing group activities. We issued that for all of our providers. There's been some interpretation about how do I do that? Well, we recognize and we've tried to, and in some of our guidance, and we've issued so much, we made some clarifications that given your staffing situation and that of your residents, you can do some accommodations around the dining piece and doing some staggering or doing some different things that respect social distancing and the intent here of taking steps to minimize the risk of transmission in your facility by doing these things. So there's a recognition of populations. We've talked before, and it's still, if you've got questions about this in your particular circumstance, call long-term care, talk to one of the nurses up here, talk it through, and let us talk it through with you.
So now that we're looking at phases of reopening the state, depending on which phase you are and everything, where do we see nursing homes in this? When do we think they'll open back up to the public?
So, You may have noticed that there's been lifting of restrictions that's going on across the country. I mean, how could you not notice that, right? And, you know, for most of you, I suspect it's raising your apprehensions. It's not a relief. It's raising my apprehensions. I'm concerned about your staff. We talked about this last week. You know, your staff, you know, are getting out, and their risk of exposure increases as they go out, and then the risk of them bringing it back into your facility. There's CMS has not issued any particular guidance. We've not had any signaling at this point of lessening of the restrictions in our nursing facilities. I suspect that we're going to see some long-term consistent changes in how we care for residents and how we monitor and restrict the staff and the visitors in our facilities for a long time. This isn't going to go away quickly. Until we have a vaccine in place, or we can vaccinate like we are doing for the flu right now, pneumonia, I see us having to remain vigilant. So I wish I had a nicer answer for you, but I think that's the reality. Janine's shaking her head over there. I think she might even say I'm absolutely, I wouldn't go that far, but anyway, So the governor lifted his restriction. I'll wrap this answer up. The governor's executive order, fifth amended, that came out on the 30th, did lift or will lift the restrictions for those age 65 and older and vulnerable populations, significant underlying medical conditions, I think is the term used there. That's going to lift on May 15th. So... And that was that they stay home. So that's going to lift on the 15th, and so we're all cognizant of that. That all right? How do we translate that? So we're working in this next week to have some guidance for next week on this. All right, what do we do? What about staff? You know, in our we talked about last week, group homes, ICF IDs. We got staff who work. How do we deal with that? What about family visitation and what provisions are going to be made for that? So we're all wrestling with that. We're all wanting to be really careful about how we do that. That provides access to families and to residents, but yet gives you the room to protect your staff and your residents. So all of that's got to be reconciled, and it's not going to be an easy I do not envision that it's going to be an easy reconciliation or not prone to lots of, well, what about, you know, all these different circumstances that come up.
So one more question, some status updates. Visitation for families when the resident is end of life. CMS released guidance on this early on, recommending that the facilities provide for those families who have a resident that's approaching end of life. And you should work with your nursing home, your facility, to make arrangements such that in some way, I don't know exactly what that looks like, that you are able to spend some time with your loved one as they are in this phase.
Yeah, and I would, so just you are expected to screen those visitors, let them know before they come. It's like, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have your temperature taken. We're going to ask you about your, you know, if you've been in close contact with someone who's COVID positive right now, you can't come. You know, the guidance says for those folks, don't allow them in the facility. But otherwise, for those who clear that screening and the temperature check, they're going to put a face mask. You know, the expectation would be put a face mask on them. You don't need to put a face shield on someone who's coming in necessarily, I suppose, but that'll be a situational evaluation, I suppose.
Well, and
if it's a COVID
The resident may be COVID positive as well. So.
And I would say a majority of the facilities that have had this happen, most have said we've put full PPE on them, provided them a mask and a face shield and a gown and gloves. I am a nurse. I have a huge heart, and I believe that if anyone is dying, that you do not offer their family gloves. Allow them that personal touch. That skin-to-skin contact is very important. We still say don't, you know, we're not going to sit up in the bed with them. We're not going to hug them and get that physically close. But allow them to hold their hand. Allow that not to come through with a pair of gloves on. You're supposed to promote hand hygiene consistently throughout, and that is the opportunity for that family member to perform hand hygiene as well. And the screening, you know, a lot of you were screening before the visitation was completely restricted. They are well aware. I am going to put a plug in for the screening across the board. Make sure that your screening questionnaires include the new subset of symptoms, not just respiratory and temperature and travel questions. I think the travel questions at this point are potentially not as stated with, you know, I've been out of the country or anything like that, or on a, you know, cruise. A lot of cruises have stopped. Add in some of those other symptoms and questioning of those symptoms.
Okay, I'm going to move along pretty quick. I want to make sure we have some time for question and answers today. I have a note here that says CMPs are approval to fund. Did Diane?
So we just got word. We've cleared some money. We actually suspended some contracts. I think I even mentioned that last week. But so we're going to be pushing out some guidance. I think Diane thinks she might make it later today on the application process for communication devices.
Okay. I want to remind you we're still doing infection control consults. You can call up the long-term care at 405-271-6868, and we'll get either Paula or Janine to give you an infection control consult. Even Rhonda, who's been working on that. I do want to give a shout-out to Pam Caldwell, who helps arrange all of our webinars and how smoothly they go, because it just reminded me earlier this week I was on a really crappy one. And so I just want to say thank you. COVID-focused surveys, as I said last week, the feds are still the federal regional office, Dallas, is doing COVID-focused surveys. They've done about 9 in Oklahoma. You will probably continue to see them do those, as well as the state agency. And additionally, we have long-term care surveyors that are a part of the district task force that's out there. A lot of them right now are working on the testing that's become so prevalent in the last week, and we'll probably be doing that for a while. Reporting requirements, remember to report within 24 hours. I also want to say that those task force that are out there are operating on behalf of the Commissioner of Health, Long-Term Care Services, so they are under our authority, and so when they are asking you for something, please be cooperative and work with them. With that, you want to say something?
Yeah, on the task force. So I've gotten a few questions about the task force. So Oklahoma City and Tulsa, our state has established that Oklahoma City and Tulsa are independent of the state health department. We are working to coordinate with them on the testing and how that's done. But I'm hearing about some inconsistencies there. As that's emerging, we're trying to address that. If they initially reach out to you and they put the plan to you in one format, and then you want to discuss with them, go ahead and, you know, it's like, well, what about, could we do it this way?
have that conversation with them. It's like, okay, I understand. Can we do this way? Can we? I've heard some of the facilities are doing it this way. Could we do this? As I said before, they were asked and instructed to coordinate and have some flexibility with you in getting this done.
And on that note, we'll move into question and answers. So, Pam, if you'll get that tuned up for us and give us just a second, we'll get to our first caller.
Yeah, y'all will be prompted, your questions will be taken in order.
This conference is now in question and answer mode. To alert the speaker that you have a question, press 1, then 0.
And it generally takes a minute. There they come. Go ahead, caller.
If I have a client that goes home for a home visit prior to the quarantine of 14 days being lifted, and when they come back, we no longer have to quarantine. Is that correct?
No, in actuality, if they have left the facility, you're going to start that clock over again.
Go ahead. Well, as I say, this points to the difficulty of those that have residents who are working and would leave and come back. And
Is that what we're talking
about? No, I don't think that's what she's talking about. They went home to visit. But anybody who's leaving and comes back is potentially exposed.
Regardless of
And now you would want to quarantine them so that they don't expose the rest of your population.
I agree. My problem is I have a family member who is insistent on removing his loved one prior to the no visitation being lifted. If he brings him back after the visitation stop has been lifted, do I still quarantine?
Well, so there's a lot of unknowns with that, because if the visitation is lifted, there still may be some constraints on that visitation that you're going to screen them, you're going to do a temperature check, you're going to put a face mask on them. You've got control over that exposure when they come into your building, mostly.
I don't think we live in an environment where it will go back to what we once had.
Well, and I'll just throw this out there. I believe it should still be in the CDC guidelines where they actually talk about if you do allow visitors to come in because you may have somebody that they're refusing to eat and drink and even get out of the bed because they can't see their family, you know, have a room in your facility that is near the front where you can screen that visitor, you can put a mask and all that on them, and put the resident in that room with their family member for a visit. And that way they're not tracing through the facility, but they still get to see them. You can still maintain your quarantine within the facility with that individual, but you're giving them that opportunity for a visit if that prevents the family from coming and taking them out of the facility by providing them, you know, that ability to at least visit, but it's in a controlled, contained environment where you only have one-on-one. And, you know, one visitor at a time, kind of back to the good old days, I say that jokingly, in the hospital where you were only allowed one person at the bedside. It's kind of similar to that, to be able to maybe avoid the leaving and extending to a new 14-day set.
Next question. Go ahead. Next question.
Hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, thank you. This is in regards to dialysis. When we have a resident that goes out for dialysis, we have the regular checking of the temperature and all when they return, and have them wash their hands, and if they have any items with them, such as a blanket that they might have taken, we immediately put those in the trash bag and take those to be laundered. Is there any additional precautions that we should be taking? Plus, they are doing a med ride you know, for the dialysis.
Is the med ride considered a professional health care person?
That I don't have answered.
I mean, the dialysis would be considered professional health care.
Right. So, not sure what setting they're coming back to. You know, your dialysis folks that come and go 3 times a week, they're unfortunately going to be stuck in a continuous loop of 14-day quarantine to ensure, because they are going out. Dialysis has their own set of CDC guidelines.
I think this is nursing homes sending them out for dialysis.
Right.
And then
correct. Sorry. Yes.
That's okay, but they still need you to be on that continuous loop for 14 days, unfortunately. The practice with the linen and all that is amazing. That is perfect. Continue to do that. As far as other precautionary things, is that what you're asking for with that population?
Yes, you know, if there was anything additional. And now that you're mentioning that 14 days, he has a private room, but he's not, you know, on the end, should I say, you know, normal if somebody had returned from the hospital for the 14 days. He does have a private room, though. Should we have taken that to the extent not to be in the communal dining as well as a dialysis patient?
If it's somebody that needs a full assist, though, you're able to do that.
Is not.
Okay. So ideally, no, not in the communal dining. Obviously, health and well-being, mental health, and so on. Staggering, ensuring no one is, you know, there with that individual. Your med ride, I would have a conversation with med ride to see what those drivers are doing. A majority of folks that transport patients are wearing a mask. If they aren't, they should be. Same as the resident should be wearing a mask. Because they are in a confined space, there are some guidelines about if you're in a vehicle with somebody who is positive, but it needs to stand with any transport vehicles. And most facilities that have their own, that's what they're doing. They, you know, ensure that they have a protocol that they're cleaning the vehicle down in between transports with an EPA-registered list end product. Just so you can ensure that transport piece is safe, because that is a confined space for greater than 10 minutes and likely less than 6 feet apart, depending on a van situation or if it's a wheelchair-bound person and that sort of thing.
Great advice. And just for anybody else out there, MedRite is taking all the precautions for that. And for our dialysis patients, they're, from what I understand, they're transporting them individually without anyone else in the vehicle. So they are cleaning and following guidelines for that in between each ride, regardless dialysis or however they're transporting them. So if anybody else needs to know that, thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
WLTC.
Go ahead, caller.
Yes. Maybe I missed it, but you guys said that the testing for all the residents and staff, you're getting results within 48 hours. Is that correct?
Well, so, no. They not exactly. So the laboratory is telling us they are at a 48-hour turnaround, but they were not. They got overwhelmed. We understand that they're back at 48 hours, I'm told, but that's 48 hours from their receipt. So they're working on standing up a third shift. So at this point, you're looking at probably 3 days from the sample collection before you're going to get results.
Okay. We did our testing on April 30th, and I've not received any results.
Yeah.
Is there someone I need to call? Or?
No, I think I was told about your case. That would have been last Thursday, is that right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I would have... So
And it was just staff. We had already tested all of our residents.
Okay, all right. So what I would say is follow up with your task force and ask about the status of the testing.
Okay.
My guess that you're going to get it later today or tomorrow.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Matt. Yes, this is Matt Lloyd with Methodist Manor. First, I just wanted to offer some recognition to the task force we worked with here in Tulsa. They were awesome to work with, and so anybody who gets contact with them, it was just an amazing experience. So I'd encourage you to work with them, and they were very cooperative and flexible with us.
Well, thank
question
you.
For you, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. My question, so obviously somewhat unique to us, but we have a campus where we serve assisted, skilled nursing, and independent. We've been following the same kind of visitor restrictions and essentially protective measures across all three of those living groups. Would you offer any kind of recommendation or guidance on moving forward as the state is lifting restrictions, perhaps how we should internally lift restrictions on those various populations? Especially the independent living group, you might say.
Yeah, it goes back to what – so we're wrestling with that now.
Yeah.
And we're waiting to see if we're going to get something from CDC or CMS on this. But just, you know, like the state wrestled with these phases, we're wrestling with, all right, how do you do that? But I will foreshadow that it's going to be, all right, if we resume allowing visitation, then it's going to be still with temperature screenings, still with them wearing PPE, because the bug's still out there. It didn't go. Just the fact that we've opened it up didn't go make it go away. And there's a lot of speculation. Expectation that we're going to see. With increased social contact, we're going to see the bugs coming back some more.
I think everybody has an opinion on this, and I agree with James. But I would, let's just caution, as we have that information, we'll be glad to share it with you. I am sure that CMS is close, as is the CDC, to releasing some type of guidance and recommendation. Any other? Oh, okay. Go ahead, caller.
Hello. This may sound a little repetitive, but I just want to clarify to make sure. Okay, we all keep talking about fit testing the N95s and that we don't have the proper stuff, so we can't properly be fit tested with the hoods and the saccharin and the bitter and all that. But am I, as the DON, considered qualified enough to in-service and educate my people on how to put on the N95 mask we have correctly and how to field test it? We don't have anybody positive. I was just going to teach them before it happened.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you do not have anyone fit tested, but you have N95s in your possession, and you want to know if you would be able to do just a seal check with them?
They're not the real N95s. They're the
KN95?
Yes.
So those are still things. Someone had to point that out to me because I missed it, but there are actual specifics in the OSHA guidelines related to the N95s. They have added that those should still be fit tested, even though they are a face-fitted mask. There is a potential that someone has a really small face or their bone structure is such that it wouldn't make a good seal. So there's really not a way to bypass that. And if you have something that's ill-fitted, you may think that it's sealed, but in reality you may be giving a false sense of security and telling your staff that that's fine, that it's the same protection as if you had a regular N95 that was fit tested.
And as a DOE.
Okay, I have a tentative date set up with a certified safety instructor through the technology center, but due to all the rules and regulations, they can't come out here immediately. So I just meant to, we only have one size of these little masks that we got from Merck, and I just wanted to educate my staff on that. And I've read up on it. I've watched a million videos. It's not...
Good for you.
All right. Well, I mean, am I able to teach my staff?
So there's... we're not absolutely certain of the answer for you, so because you're dealing with occupational law. So Janine, want to add something more?
There is no actual certification for educating. If you understand and that piece, yes, you are capable of doing that, but, you know, you want to make sure that folks are fit, tested, and medically cleared. And educated, that it's all the three prongs to that. So, yes.
Absolutely.
CDC guidelines for donning and doffing, you're in 95, and your extended wear and limited reuse guidelines, as long as you educate on all of those, and for the love of everything great, teach them not to touch that mask and mess around
with it. Exactly. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, caller.
We're going to have to be shorter in our answers.
Yeah.
What would your guidance be with allowing certain contractors like salon services, podiatrists, and others into assisted living and long-term care communities?
At present, none.
Yeah, we don't have anything
yet. There's no guide. I mean, that would be considered visitation such as anything else, and facilities are not open to visitation at this time.
Yeah, so you've got, are you better off to have someone come in from the salon than have your residents go out to a salon? You got to, you know, all those things, but we don't have anything right now. So I'll go back to, so we're aware this is here. We've got to start thinking this through.
Yeah.
We don't have things totally listed yet. We understand residents and families are asking, and we're going to work on this. And we will have more for you next Wednesday. I'm not saying we're going to have the answers next Wednesday. We're going to have more for you next Wednesday.
At least we're thinking about it. Do you have any other questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Next. Caller, go ahead.
Yes, I have. I am a long-term care. We do not have any COVID in our building right now. But we have some employees that are choosing to bring in N95s of their own to wear, and we have not fit tested them for that. So, you know, should we tell them to just wear the surgical mask, or is it okay for them to wear that knowing they haven't been fit tested?
So it depends on the type of N95. We have encountered folks that are, just for example, physical therapists. They've ordered the N95 neoprene, change the filter out mask. And, you know, I don't have a good answer for you. If it is not a NIOSH approved, you know, piece in place, then that is on them if they're choosing to use it. The surgical mask, as long as you are providing a surgical mask because you do not have N95s and are not fit tested at this point in time, you are still falling under the OSHA regulation that you are providing the PPE that is available for staff to put on and provide care. And to reiterate the CDC guidelines that you state, if you don't have N95s, don't have a respiratory protection program and fit testing in place, a surgical mask is appropriate.
Okay, and then I had one other question about the state has notified us that they'll be coming maybe this week or next week to do a facility-wide testing. Do we know how much notice they're going to give us before they arrive so that I can have all of my staff available?
Yeah, so they will give you some notice, and like I said, there'll be a coordination. I think what I'm hearing is it's a day or 2 days notice.
Okay, and then if I have employees that just refuse to come in during that time, then do we just have to consider them positive and act accordingly, or can they still come to work without the test?
So we'll look at the situation as it emerges, but what the instructions are to the task force is they're to get a roster from the facility of all the staff, and then they will review the samples collected and any staff that they, for which they didn't get a sample, then that's going to be marked as someone to be quarantined from the building. And so that's the protocol that's in place, is that staff who do not, so what we make clear in our guidance and what we put out there is you clearly have the authority as a requirement for this healthcare job to require the testing under EEOC rule interpretation. So that's in the guidance that we provided you. Provided you the link to that document as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have several questions left. We're not going to take any more. We still have 8 in the queue, and we're going to go a little bit longer, but we're going to try and get to those 8 questions. Go ahead, caller.
I was calling to talk about those who are working. You mentioned that very briefly. I'm with residential care, but we're licensed as residential care, but we're actually a shelter for seniors, and there are people over 60 working. Do you have any suggestions? Currently we have had to deny intake because they can't quarantine for 14 days and work.
Yeah, I've kind of given you the sense of what we're wrestling with is we're looking at this. Most of the residence cares I'm familiar with, there's not like a separate wing or building that you could put those residents who are working in separate from those who aren't. But that would be something, to think about. And then thinking about, all right, when we get to that place, can they wear a mask? Will they be good about wearing a mask while they're out in public? And hand hygiene and all those things. And then when they come back, what restrictions do you put on those that are going out and coming back in the building as opposed to the rest of your population to protect the rest of the population that's not going out?
Stay there.
Yeah, so those are all the things that we're wrestling with and to try to give you some guidance. But that's what you will need to be thinking about and working on yourself as well.
Oh, we have. So maybe even like a quarantine when they're with us to not expose anybody else.
All right, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Go ahead, caller.
Hello. I have 2 quick questions. We had our testing today, and I have to say our task force was wonderful, so I appreciate that.
Which county?
We are in Latimer County.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. We had asked about doing the testing ourselves, and they said that wasn't an option. So just to clarify, for a sister facility, that is an option because we had wanted to do that ourselves.
So I don't know the circumstances of what went on, why that was done. I understand that some of the tasks.
Well, I know we were one of the first ones, too, so it was probably.
Yeah. We did. We issued some follow-up communications to them to say, hey, if you can review the protocol with the staff on how to do that, that would be accepted. There's some discussion and some recommendations to say don't do that. But we weighed that against the issues with our staff going in facilities and trying to coordinate across all of the shifts and all the staff. And so there's been some lessening of that restriction to allow the facilities to collect some of the samples.
Okay. So that being said, my question really is, are the task force members being tested? And if so, if any of them test positive, will we be notified?
Yes, you would as someone that's been exposed. So we're working on our own testing protocol as well. And I think we'll implement that beginning early next week for the testing of our own staff and of all the task force members.
Okay, and then real quick on the testing before discharge, is there any communication or direction with the hospitals as far as isolating those residents from the time they're tested, and can we ask for that? I mean, we have asked for that, but have you all discussed that with them at all?
So are you asking about isolation of the resident while they're in the hospital?
Well, if they're going to test them, there's really not a point in testing them if they're not isolated from the point of testing. I know we have to still put them in isolation.
So you're absolutely right. That goes to the whole issue, the problems with this testing, that we're doing a discharge test that has no CDC guidance for. But we're doing this as a precautionary and a means to the discharge that gives you some sense of what you're dealing with. It's not definitive because, just like you said, regardless of when they do that, I mean, they're not totally going to isolate them. There's some staff that are going to come into that resident's room, right? So, you know, are they isolated?
But they would use the isolation procedures.
Yeah.
So what hospitals are doing that I've talked to, they actually all pretty much have set up a COVID suspect wing or location within their facility, and a majority that are getting the long-term care facility residents, if they're in there for another reason, they've got a UTI, they've fallen in and they're concerned for a hip fracture or something like that, they are placing them separate. They are also universally masking. And they will use PPE as far as gowns for contact precautions and things like that should there be that need. So a majority of the hospitals are single patient rooms, and if they're not, then that would be a question to know how they're handling your residents. But that's what a majority of them are doing. They're trying to protect your residents just as much as you are, and that's why they want to expedite getting them back out to you. But in conversing with the infection preventionists in the hospitals, that's what they're doing. And they're not crossing over staff. They're not allowing those caring for positive hospitalized patients to care for those that are not known to be positive or symptomatic.
And that's
why you see that as appropriate for us to be asking those questions, because we're getting some pushback from some facilities on those questions, and I just feel like it's important for us to be asking some of those questions.
Well, so it, when you ask if is it appropriate for you to ask the questions, the problem that I have with that is that regardless of the answer to those questions, it doesn't change the next steps, which are a 14-day quarantine.
Correct. Okay.
Go ahead.
One thing I'll just point out, there's other facilities, too, that were tested last Thursday that don't have the results back. Second, when you are considering the salons, we have some buildings where the salon employees are actual employees of the facility, and one, in fact, in which they're actually certified nurse aides. And then third, would you kind of talk to your strong feelings about or against working COVID-positive staff and COVID-positive cohorts? I've heard several people argue that, you know, if you're going to work a COVID-positive person in a COVID-positive cohort, that's probably the best person you could have.
So as far as the salon goes, you've got your own salon. You know, that's your own salon and your own staff and your own screening program. That simplifies things for you, in my mind. I think you exercise the appropriate precautions inside your salon with your staff. And, you know, then, you know, versus the scenario you've got someone externally coming in, we're going to get there to work out the salon stuff and those kinds of services that are coming in, that the staff that are coming in are going to wear their mask, and, you know, what, you know, the resident's going to wear a mask and the staff are going to wear a mask and, you know, work through that. As far as the staffing, Our concern with that, and it's just like with the questions, it is that the concern is you have someone who has known there's known exposure, they're known positive, and they're coming into the building, and I know who this caller is, and I know he's taken a lot of extra precautions in that building, so there's a lot weighing in favor of to allow that in that circumstance. That's why we put the protocols in place to evaluate that. And so we're weighing that against the risk of the staff member who's coming in, who's COVID positive, are they going to follow the infection control procedures the whole time, and all their interactions with the other staff and in that building, so that they don't accidentally drop that bug somewhere that someone else then picks up.
Yeah, it's not the interaction with the COVID positive resident. It's the probability or chance that they will infect somebody other than that. So depending on answering all the right questions, putting all the right things in place, yeah, I can see it working out.
All right.
Next question. Go ahead.
My question concerning is pre-screening process. One, does it have to be a medical personnel? Two, must there be somebody at that door 24/7? Three, if there's not a person designated, can we use a doorbell to indicate when somebody needs to come into the facility, and then we obtain their temperature and so forth and the screening process?
Yeah, I think everything you just said would be acceptable. The point is controlling the entry and the exit. And if you have a doorbell and you can get there and make sure that you screen them before they come into that facility, that's fine.
What did you mean by pre-screen? What was the context?
Pre-screening is the doors are closed, and when they enter, they must have a mask. I must take your temperature. I must ask the questionnaire, and then you can come into the building.
So I think what I'm hearing you ask is, does there have to be a medical person standing there and doing that? No. However, depending on the mechanism, the type of thermometer you're using for temperature taking can be an issue for a non-medical person to get an accurate temp. You do really want someone there to validate that someone's not taking their temperature four times before they, you know, and hopefully they're being honest. You know, your provider's coming in, they're capable of taking their own temperature, but who is validating that? And it comes up to people say, well, I was being told I had to work when I was sick, which then puts you in a bind as well. So it's good to have someone validate that and demonstrate it in your documentation that, yes, you are screening and here's your proof. And someone has validated that we haven't breached a 99.2 temperature without retaking it or whatever your protocol looks like. So, but someone has to kind of see that. Some facilities have placed their charge nurse responsible for that when there's not someone there to actively screen, perhaps on a weekend or night shift, so that you do have that base covered.
Okay.
Next question.
Go ahead, caller.
In regard to reporting residents that are being tested, if we have, say, a resident that's here for skilled care that maybe has an abdominal issue and they're having abdominal pain that results from them returning to the emergency room, emergency rooms more in general are doing COVID tests on anybody that's in a nursing home because they're considered high risk. Would all of those need to be state reported, even if the condition is not COVID related, if they do a swab for them in the emergency room?
Just we need it recorded one time.
Yeah, probably not. The reporting would not be on you. It would be where the positive test goes through. So if an ER tests them and it goes through that lab, the laboratory will report it and they will notify you, obviously, if it's positive. For your awareness, you would be able to say, hey, I have a positive in my facility now. And I don't know about how medical facilities feels about it, but I believe just the notification they were tested at the outside facility and you received them, that it was a positive, so that they're aware.
But
thank you.
If the test is negative, they do. Do we still need to do a state report, basically saying they tested
them? So we talk about that in the. So the agenda went out today with the agenda from last week's call and the FAQ, and that's covered in there as well about that second test and those what's reported to us.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead, caller.
If in long-term care, if a resident tests positive, we quarantine them for 2 weeks. Can this resident go back to their normal room with a roommate?
So you have a resident who tested positive. So then at that point, it's not about a two-week quarantine. It's about treating that resident in their cohorted reserve section where you're treating your COVID positive population. If that's your only resident that you have, you still want to cohort them. You want to move them to the end of a wing and set up a separate space that tells everyone, I'm now moving into COVID space. And then you're going to treat that resident. Janine's going to pick up the story.
If that person was positive and their roommate was not, do not put a previous positive that you have cleared in with a negative individual. You don't want to, especially if you're doing just your symptom-based removal, you don't want to put a known previous positive in with a known negative.
Did we answer your question?
Well, yes, but what happens if we run out of rooms?
You're going to have to consider relocation possibly.
Yeah, so, I mean, you do. You have to think about that. You have to think about moving some residents to another facility and things of that nature. Yeah.
Or if you have additional previous positives that you can room together, that's your alternative.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Question.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm just needing some clarification on the COVID testing requirement, I guess, for those coming from a hospital to the long-term care facility. Is that they're going to have a test, and we're requiring this currently at our facility 48 hours prior to their discharge, but and then we're putting them on a holding unit, and then we are initiating a second test 3 days after they've been in our facility. Do those, am I understanding, I was only on part of the call today, but am I understanding that all new admissions must be quarantined for 14 days?
That is correct.
So where is that guidance at? I'm just kind of reading off of the Oklahoma Health Alert Network update that was sent out on April 23rd. Has there been a new one of those that I'm missing?
That guidance has been in place for some time regarding the cohorting of residents and new admissions. That's been in some of the CMS guidance for nursing facilities as well. So and it's on the CDC. So I can appreciate your difficulty in finding that guidance because there's been a lot that's been put out. We will go back through we'll do our Q&A response.
On a new website to reorganize and make it a little bit easier. It's also on the CDC guidance.
And Janine
if
says,
you go to the FAQs, where the question is asked, do hospitals have to are they required to have two negative tests before they return? In that section, it spells out for you that nursing homes should place individuals in transmission-based precautions in a separate observation area or single-person room until 14 days have elapsed since admission. That is when CDC recommends if you are going to test to remove them from that. that you do it at the end of that 14 days, and that's in the FAQs under the infection control section.
I'll look there. The confusion is just going off of, I guess, the most recent guidance that we got from the State Department of Health in the Oklahoma Healthcare Alert Network health update dated April 23rd.
Yeah.
It clearly states patients with no history of COVID-19.
Yeah.
That means they're at the hospital, they've had no history of COVID-19, they get a test prior to leaving the hospital, and they come to us. And then once they're here, if negative, that first test, then we would do a second test administered in accordance with CDC guidelines, which is just greater than 24 hours.
See, that's the problem. So we went through that, and we scoured for the CDC guidance, and there is no CDC guidance for a patient who never was suspected of COVID to have a first or second test. That's the problem, is that got confused about that next test for someone who was and had previous COVID exposure, and now you're taking them off, versus someone who never had it.
And both of those are addressed. The long-term care facility page is where it's addressed under dedicate space and facility to monitor and care for residents with COVID-19. But it speaks to someone who has never been infected, that's when you would consider testing at the end of the 14-day quarantine.
And because your question has come up before, actually, Janine had identified to us, and we had a conversation about this during the call, that we're going to sit down and kind of narrow, try to get some more nuanced guidance to address this circumstance.
Okay, thank you.
Janine had a – go ahead, Janine.
I just want to – there were a couple things I didn't point out. Whenever you all are doing the universal masking like you should be, please monitor your staff that they're wearing their masks appropriately. A number of folks are wearing them under their nose, and that is not helpful.
That's not how they're supposed to be worn?
No, it's kind of – I heard something really funny the other night, but I won't say it. Just make sure the nose is covered, because that's where you're going to find those – viral nasties. The cohort video that many of you have been using on the state website, please be advised that is being redone in a couple of sections because CDC guidelines changed, and also just due in part to the numerous takes that I had to do with our marketing folks. That video is going to be corrected to clarify the extended wear of the PPE in specific cohorts. So please be aware there will be an update to that. And then those of you that have dialysis folks that are coming and going from your facility, I would encourage you to go and pull some of those guidelines related to COVID on those pages. That's going to tell you a little bit about what they're doing and how they should be screening and following.
Which pages?
Dialysis.
Okay,
so
we're going to go to CDC Infection Control Dialysis?
I believe it is.
Just trying to help folks.
Yeah, it's under those that infection control section, your other facilities. And that will help you all, too, to kind of ask some of those questions that you're fielding our way. I am not as well versed in the dialysis ones, but they did release some new changes to those just yesterday as well.
Yep.
Thanks for being with us today. Our next session will be May 13th at 1 o'clock. Be safe.